Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for participating in today's webinar, Employee Classification, Why It Matters. My name is Lizette Perez-Dysbeck, and I am the General Counsel of Battery Ventures. If you're on this call, you're likely an employee or a member of a Battery Ventures portfolio company, so we really appreciate you making it. On behalf of the firm and of Goodwin Procter, we thank you for making time. We want to be a resource for you, and we're hoping that this you will find this useful. Here with me is Jennifer Fay. Jennifer is a partner at Goodwin Procter. Jennifer has been an employment lawyer for the better part of 20 years. She is a unique lawyer as far as employment law goes, in that Jennifer works both with early stage companies in planning around employee issues, and she works with companies around transactions when they're being sold or they're going public. But she's also a litigator, so if all goes wrong and you're faced with a claim, she is the person who goes to court. So she has a great perspective that I think you'll find helpful on these issues around employee classifications. We know that this subject, at least I think the subject, is dry. So we will try to have a format here that moves things along and that makes it somewhat, you know, a little bit less dry. We're going to try to cover generally three things. We're going to try to give you basics. We're going to try to give you some tools and resources that you can take with you ultimately. In fact, you should watch your email after this webinar is finished, because we'll be sending you some instructions on how you can access materials either at the Goodwin Procter site or perhaps by email. But so be on the lookout for that. And we're hoping that we can give you some practical advice on how to answer questions as you're determining whether a worker is an employee, an independent contractor, or how it should be classified. With that in mind, we also are mindful that we have a range of companies, generally in technology and technology-enabled businesses, but some of you have 1 to 20 employees, some of you have 500 to 1,000 employees, and we're going to speak to all of you. The rules do apply to all of you, regardless of whether you're a baby company or you're a very, very mature company. So I think that that's why this will be helpful across the board. With that in mind, Jennifer, why do we care? Why is it important to have this conversation about worker classification?
Well, thanks, Lizette, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm pleased to be here, and Lizette is right that I have worked with companies across the board. So I'll try to keep my comments pretty general. It certainly is the case that everyone does need to be concerned about worker classification issues. I have seen over the last few years a trend in my own practice of classification issues being more and more important, both in the litigation and in the transactional front. In preparation for today's webinar, I did a little bit of research on trends and sort of tried to get a couple of stats to help out put this in perspective, and found that there was a growth between 2004, which notably was the time when the FLSA issued its most recent set of regulations, and 2009, that represents over 120% increase in litigation in this area. So, of course, if your company is caught in this, in the crosshairs of this trend, it can be really expensive, time-consuming, distracting. And many times it can be avoided if people just understand the rules of the game and apply them correctly. So oftentimes I'm counseling clients, and they'll find that, boy, you know, if we just understood this, we could have done it differently. We could have structured the pay differently. We could have structured, called this person an employee from the outset rather than an independent contractor. And I just wish that we didn't now have to go back and try to undo all of this. So hopefully we'll be providing you with some of those tools now to give you the proactive information to be proactive about this in the future. And then we'll also talk about ways in which, if you do recognize that there are some concerns, that we can go, you can try to mitigate the risks by undoing some of the things that may have been done in a way that you're not totally comfortable with now. Okay. So when we get to why it really matters, so let's just throw a couple of numbers out there. 2006, I found a $90 million judgment against Farmers Insurance for unpaid overtime. $172 million jury verdict in 2005 against Walmart. $135 million in back wages against Farm Mutual Insurance was settled. So these deficits, and that was even obviously before a trial, enormous concern about the risk of liability resulted in that large settlement. Some smaller numbers, Singular Wireless, $5.1 million recent settlement for misclassified customer service representatives who were classified as exempt. In 2008, many of you may have heard Starbucks has been gotten themselves into some trouble in this area, paid $3 million for expense reimbursement violations. In that case, it was under California law. Hewitt paid $4.9 million for alleged misclassification of its benefits analysts, another group, just an example of a group of employees that everyone thought were likely exempt employees. And I'll just, to cap it off, I'll mention what I call think about as being one of the granddaddy of the settlements, which is when Walmart agreed to pay $640 million to settle class actions in December of 2008.
Yeah, one thing there, Jennifer, I mean, in addition to sort of these big name companies, we are also seeing, and I think this is your experience too, that smaller companies that don't, you know, they may not make the paper because their name is not, you know, in the consumer products, for instance, space or retail space, but, you know, we had an experience with one of our portfolio companies as well where they ended up settling a claim for way more money than, you know, anybody wants to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it was a distraction for management. It's a distraction for everybody in addition to sort of being money out the door. So can you talk a little bit about deals?
Yeah.
And how, you know, hopefully you're not subject to a claim and things work out great, but then you wake up one day and you have a great offer to buy the company.
Yeah, absolutely. That has been an issue that's come up in a number of the transactions I've been involved in, particularly in the last year. Just by way of example, one company that I was working for, their business that we were helping with a deal, the business model was really based on the use of independent contractors. And the company was very profitable, and then a transaction that eventually did take place. But the transaction, the purchase price of the transaction was based on the profitability of the company that was in large part based on the fact that they were using independent contractors instead of employees. And of course, you know, many times the reason why independent contractors are elected is because it is a lot less expensive than to use an employee. There's, you know, we have a slide here that talks about a 30% decrease in price to use contractors over employees. So next slide on that one. So as a result, in that particular transaction, the buyer became highly concerned about this classification issue, and there were various ways in which those issues can be solved. It did jeopardize the deal. They can also be solved through, you know, indemnification. It can affect the purchase price, but it became when employment issues are often thought of as being sort of the flea on the dog of a transaction. This became the body of the dog. Was the classification of the particular service providers, the workers in this instance. So, you know, that's one example. On that exempt versus non-exempt, the other thing that I've seen is some of our smaller companies, as they're growing, they will call everyone a salaried employee and say, well, everyone's a professional. We don't pay overtime because everybody works hard. It's the way it's the culture here, and we don't want to have any sense of, you know, whether people punching clocks or any of those kinds of concerns that people can get caught up in the workplace. We just want everyone to come here and work really hard. Well, when a buyer comes in and starts to look carefully at these issues, and certainly when I'm on the buy side, I do that, and you find that everyone's been paid a salary, no one's been paid overtime, then there is a vulnerability there and a potential for litigation in the future. And again, that's something that that will really can affect the transaction in a material way.
So we've talked, we've sort of thrown around the word classification, and I want to mention, I'm going to be asking questions of you, but I want to let everybody know that we'll also be accepting questions throughout our presentation via email. So I get to talk and you guys get to write. And if you want to submit a question, you should just click on the questions pane in your control panel, type in your question, hit send, and I'll try to keep track of those and sort of weave them in to the extent we can. If not, we'll answer them at the end. So let's start with basics. You know, when you say classification issues, you know, what does it mean? When a person walks in the door to work, I guess they're a worker, and you have to make a decision about how they're classified. What does that mean?
Right. So a worker comes in, and you first need to decide, should that person be paid as an independent contractor or an employee? Very basic. Again, the reason why people may or companies may opt to use the independent contractor classification is because it seems simpler, it feels less permanent. You just issue a 1099. You don't need to worry about benefits, or there's a belief that you don't need to worry about benefits. And it's sometimes companies use that as a way of interviewing the person, even by calling them a contractor, and then they hire them as an employee. And the person continues to do the exact same job, but then is paid as a W-2 employee down the road. Oftentimes, I get the calls at that time, and they'll say, oh, we want to convert this independent contractor over to an employee. Turns out, well, how long have they been an independent contractor? Oh, 4 years, and they've been paid as a 1099, and then you're going to move over to have this person be an employee. So the classification issue first is a person properly classified as an independent contractor or an employee? And then once they get to you determine whether or not they're an employee, then you have to determine they should be an employee, then it's exempt versus non-exempt. But let's first start with the independent contractor classification.
So why do people choose, why do businesses default to independent contractor oftentimes? Because that's what you see, right?
Yeah. Again, it's really a cost savings issue, and also sort of a misimpression that if somebody is working either on a part-time basis or on what they think maybe a temporary basis, that an independent contractor is a proper classification. However, it really does relate to control. It comes down to, you know, there are many tests, and they different states have different statutes on this, some which are more stringent than others. But, you know, even at the federal level, the IRS has an 11-factor test out there that you look at to determine whether someone is properly classified as a 1099 worker. In bottom line, what you want to think about is, does the person, is the person acting on his or her own with respect to the means in which they carry out the job that they're being hired to do. And if the person has a job title, if the person has a boss, it's almost certain that the person is then not properly classified as an independent contractor.
So let's push this a little bit, because cost is important for the company, right?
Yeah.
So we're trying to save money here.
Yeah.
We're trying to make it last long. Of course, we don't want to take crazy risks, but so we agree. But classifying somebody as an independent contractor, probably, certainly in the short term, maybe not in the long term,
right,
for the reasons we're talking, costs you less. But why is it so hard to satisfy that test? I mean, I do understand, you just said, if you bring somebody in and you give her a title and you give her, you know, a list of responsibilities, and she has to show up in the mornings and she has to be there at least 3 days a week, you know, whatever it is, then it walks like a duck, you know, it's likely a duck. But why is it so hard to be an independent contractor?
Well, again, it really does depend on the different tests that you're looking at. If you're looking at the federal level, it's because most companies do want to control their workers. And the IRS says, if you're controlling this person, and there's more to it, I'm simplifying it, but if you're controlling this person, then this person is an employee, and that to call them an independent contractor and to avoid payroll taxes that are associated with that, and to be using this as a way of accomplishing business goals instead of calling them employees. When your competitors are calling people employees, you then gain an advantage by violating provisions of the tax code. And then there are certain workers who then are not perhaps going to be benefit eligible, and that is also something that many states will take umbrage to and will try to take enact statutes to prevent that from happening as well. So it's the reason why, you know, that's why the test at the federal level has been, it really is about the avoidance of taxes is why they've put this control test out there. And the states in some instances have made that even more stringent because the states have identified what they call a tax gap, and they also are trying, again, to protect their citizens by ensuring that they're receiving all the rights and benefits that employees are otherwise entitled to.
So just one point on that. For the benefit of everybody who's listening, we have folks on the phone who are from Massachusetts, California, all over the place, and in a way we're trying to cover everything without being able to cover anything specifically. Being in Massachusetts, I know that this test here for independent contractor is crazy difficult.
Yeah.
It's not impossible to meet,
nope.
But it's certainly very, very difficult. So, you know, I think that point is worth making. But what about if you have an agreement with the person? So, for instance, when you hire an independent contractor, you typically will sign a consulting agreement, and there'll be a little paragraph in there that says, by the way, we all agree that you're an independent contractor, and we're not withholding, and it's your problem.
Right, right.
Yeah,
certainly, you know, that can help from a practical standpoint. And here's why. If everyone's on the same page and says, you know, and there are some individuals, many of you listening may think, boy, yeah, I'm independent contractors, but my workers want to be independent contractors. They are, you know, they have their whole business structured around, or their compensation structured around the fact that they are independent contractors. There are certain deductions that they can take as an independent contractor that they may not be able to take as an employee. So I don't believe that they're going to challenge it. The fact that I have this agreement and we all are on the same page, why does the IRS or any states need to get involved in this? Well, I think that agreement can lower the risk, because if the one way in which this can become a problem for a company is the individual who's misclassified can go and can make a claim for failure to pay overtime, for example, or a violation of one of the state laws, and then that can be costly to the company. And if the employee really does agree to this in writing, then obviously that makes it less likely that that will happen. Where I've seen this unfold is when there's a layoff or a reduction in force, and the independent contractor is then dismissed or let go at the same time, and maybe that independent contractor does not get the same severance benefits, for example, as the employees who have been let go at that time. And they start to think about that classification and say, boy, you know, I've been working for pretty much doing the same job as somebody else for a long period of time, and why aren't I getting the same benefits? And why wasn't I paid the same? Well, this really wasn't a great deal for me. And then they start making, and now I don't have a deal at all because now I've been let go. That piece of paper is not going to provide you with the protection that you hope it would when that person files a claim with their state attorney general's office. So, you know, can it help? Yes. Does it ultimately protect the company? No, it really doesn't.
So on independent contractors, and I think you've covered sort of the consequences of misclassifying somebody, but I'll give an example in context that has happened to me, not in my role at Battery, but with another client. The way this has come up for me is, you have somebody who you feel you've classified properly as an independent contractor, and they're, you know, whatever their project is finished, and they go off to do something else, and then they file for unemployment.
Yes, that comes, yes.
And then you get the little piece of paper from unemployment that says, you know, object, decide whether you want to object, and you're like,
yep.
What? You know, that person was not an independent contractor. Of course, we did not treat him as an employee. We didn't make withholdings, et cetera. And you decline appropriately because that's what you think the right thing is to do, but the squeaky wheel or whatever wakes up the, you know, state authorities, and they show up and they're like, we're going to audit you.
Yeah.
You know, and even if with that respect to that guy who went and filed unemployment inappropriately, you did it right, it puts everybody under scrutiny, you know, and creates issues. And in my example was actually before the law in Massachusetts became more stringent, you know, so it was years ago, but it was really a hassle, ultimately.
It's an excellent example, and one that I dealt with just a couple of months ago with a client. In many states now have these joint task force that people are from various disciplines are then alerted once, so the taxing authorities would be alerted once the Department of, you know, related to whatever the State Department that administers the unemployment compensation program would then, you know, find that this person has been misclassified. And the questioning can be quite intense, and they can ask not just about that one particular employee or worker, but how else do you use independent contractors, provide information about that, because we may need to go back and to seek additional back payments into the unemployment compensation fund. So it becomes a very concerning issue, even with this one person who raises this at the time of termination.
Even if you did it right there. So, okay, so it sounds like if you do it wrong, you run the risk of a tax audit. There could be tax forces at the state level, sort of the labor folks, the tax folks that can come after you. Then there's this lawsuit, just independent claim from the person.
That's right.
Who could come after you. And then there's in the deal context. So that's sort of the litigation
yes.
claim context. But in the deal context, if your buyer or your underwriter's doing diligence for your IPO, you know, or whoever, you know, it could create, you know, bigger escrow,
mm-hmm.
reduction of purchase price,
yep.
indemnification, you know, risk that you don't want, you know, or hopefully not, but it could really sort of, you know,
sour the deal. If the whole business model is based on this, then it can even sour the deal. That obviously would be a very extreme consequence for it, but yes.
Okay. And the claim would be that because you did not treat this person as employee, there could be you didn't withhold appropriately, you owe them overtime. Actually, overtime in this context is a little bit different, but sort of what will they be claiming?
Yeah, so you're right on the IRS, the withholdings and the penalties associated with that. In addition, the liability under the FLSA and state wage laws, and I'm going to apologize because on my slide 7, I'm noticing that the damage multipliers plus interest and attorney's fees should really be attached to the second bullet, not the first one. And that's for, I think it is in the parens, but it's not under, it shouldn't be attached to the IRS liabilities, including interest and penalties. The FLSA issues, if you have someone who is misclassified as an independent contractor, or let's start even before that, many times companies say, well, no, the person wasn't entitled to overtime because he was an independent contractor, and so he's not protected by the FLSA. That's true, as long as that classification is done correctly. If, on the other hand, it was done incorrectly, and that person was performing non-exempt work or was paid on something other than on a salary basis, that person then can then go and challenge the fact that he never received overtime for hours worked in excess of 40 in a given work week. So you're not immune from FLSA liability because you have independent contractors providing services. To the contrary, it could be that even people who may otherwise be exempt, if you call them employees and pay them a salary, are not exempt because you call them an independent contractor and pay them in a different way.
Okay, so it sounds like the most conservative approach is, let me take that back. It sounds like the independent contractor test is tough, and you've sort of convinced me that, you know, if I'm going to pick a default, the default is employee,
right?
If I were to pick a default.
And not that it's always wrong. I just want to be clear. There are times when you can properly classify. We are sort of giving the parade of horribles here, but there are times when proper classifications of independent contractor.
Okay, so in the decision tree, I've gone through that first independent contractor employee. Now I'm going down the employee route.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about, we keep saying exempt and non-exempt. So if you can speak to the basics on that, but speak to the basics on it, keeping in mind that, you know, a lot of the people that our companies may be hiring are people who come for, you know, on a temporary basis, on a project basis. They may be part-time. It could be a few days a week. So it's not your standard, I walk in, I work 40 hours,
right.
You know, I have overtime that way, et cetera.
Right.
So it's, you know, that's where I think sort of the more challenging, is this an independent contractor or an employee, and then if you're an employee, what are you? If you can talk a little bit about exempt and non-exempt in that context and beyond, that'd be great.
Sure. And I guess I'll start by saying, because somebody's a part-time employee doesn't mean that they're an independent contractor. You can be, a part-time worker. You can, if looking at the control test, if you're going to be directing that person in terms of the manner in which they perform their services, then even if the person is working part-time or on a temporary basis, it's highly likely that that person should be paid as an employee. When we talk about exempt or non-exempt, okay, exempt from what? Exempt from the overtime provisions and the minimum wage requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act is really what we mean. So exempt means that if you pay the person a salary, and you, in most instances, and there are some exceptions that we'll talk about, and you meet the duties test that we'll talk about as well, then you do not need to worry about keeping track of that person's hours, because there is no record-keeping requirement with respect to the number of hours in which they work, and that person will not be entitled to additional compensation for time worked in excess of 40 in a given work week. Okay. If, on the other hand, they either are not paid in accordance with the FLSA salary test, and or they don't meet the duties test that we'll talk about, one of the duties tests, then that person is non-exempt, meaning that they need to be paid overtime. You need to keep track of that person's hours, which is something that bothers clients quite often. And to the extent that person works more than 40 hours in a given work week, you need to pay that person time and a half. Or unless you adopt something else called the fluctuating work week method, which is a little bit beyond the scope of what we're going to get into today.
Okay, so, and there's record-keeping obligations,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. The record-keeping one, again, is one that can be objectionable to many clients who like people to have, you know, they want their culture to be, you come in, you do your job, we don't pay attention every minute that you're here, and you go home when you think it's the best time for you to go home. I understand that. It's also something that is risky. If for example, someone who's an administrative assistant who works in that capacity and comes in when he or she thinks it's appropriate and then goes home but always gets the work done, but then later on that relationship ends or sours for some reason, and then turns around and says, you know, I should have been paid overtime. I really worked 50, 60, 70 hours on some weeks. And you turn and think about it and say, well, no, not really. You came in late often. Yes, you did sometimes stay till 8 o'clock at night. Well, there's a presumption favoring the employee's statements about overtime work if that record-keeping has not properly, record-keeping obligation has not been complied with.
Okay, so that's helpful. So exempt means somebody who's, well, if you do it right, exempt means somebody who's exempt, they don't get overtime, and non-exempt means somebody who gets overtime.
That's right.
Boiled down to its very basic sort of terms.
Yep.
But you mentioned the exemptions, and I think that a lot of us sort of think, well, there are these buckets that certainly have good titles on them. There are these buckets of employees that are, you know, and now we're overusing the word exemption for a minute, but they're exceptions to the rule. So can you talk a little bit about what the exemptions are and what the rules relating to salary compensation of exempt employees are?
Absolutely. And I'm going to start out by saying that some of the exemptions here really are misnomers. So people will think about what it means to be an executive and think that they understand that exemption, but as we'll talk about today, it's not really the case. Same thing with professional, administrative computer, all of them really, even outside sales. These white-collar exemptions have very specific rules, some of which really are pretty much outdated given the way that the modern workplace operates, but we'll talk about those as we go through. With respect to salary, Lizette, there is a minimum salary level that needs to be paid in order for the person, many of the exemptions, to apply and to even be able to consider whether someone could be exempt from the overtime rules. Now, with the exception of outside sales, which we'll talk about in a minute, the other primary exemptions, it's essential that the employees receive a set salary, which means that they need to be paid at least $455 a week, that regardless of the number of hours in which that person performs services.
Okay, so in that I see in your slide that 23,660. So as a threshold matter, somebody who doesn't get paid that.
Right, and it doesn't mean, it means that you can't, it's more than just they make over $24,000 last year. It's that they need to be paid that on a regular salary basis, regardless of the number of hours in which they work. So in other words, the variations of the time worked or quality of work, you really can't make changes to the base salary based on that. There's no pay docking. You need to be very careful about deducting for partial day absences, with the exception of someone's on an FMLA leave, or otherwise you really have, there are quite a few restrictions, all of which we can't get into now. But in general, that salary needs to be static as a base in order to meet that first part of the test.
Okay, so let's break this down, sort of an exemption at a time. The first one is executive exemption. Is that just for senior executives at companies?
No, it's not just for senior. I'm sorry. Now we're having a little bit of problem with the slide. To move that ahead, we're going to keep talking, but we'll be moving that ahead in a moment. The executive employee exemption certainly sounds like it's only for senior executives, where in fact it's not. This relates to somebody whose primary duty is the management of at least a department or a subdivision. So it can be a lower level employee. However, they need to customarily and regularly direct the work of two or more full-time employees, and also have the ability to hire or fire the other employees, or at least make that recommendation. That recommendation is really given particular weight with respect to those determinations.
Okay, so you have executive exemption, a couple of people being supervised. Administrative exemption is the next one, right?
Yeah.
And that to me sounds like, you know, EAs, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Executive assistants, administrative assistants, et cetera.
Yeah.
Is that right? I mean, can you just sort of say that that's okay?
Yeah.
Know, overtime for them?
Lisa, this is one of the most common mistakes that clients make, which is the belief that the administrative exemption means that administrative employees fall within that exemption. I wonder why they would think that. right. It's not the case. And in fact, this exemption is probably the one that is litigated the most often, because it does encompass goes across industries and across different workforces too. It really means that the primary duty is the performance of office or non-manual work that's directly related to the management or general operations of the employer or the employer's customers, okay? So the primary duty, you think about what's the essence of this person's job. When you get that, you think about, does that person have to exercise discretion and independent judgment with respect to matters of significance? So I'm saying there's a multiple there, and all of those terms that I just said have been litigated, and there's, you know, there are countless cases out there on interpreting these different terms. But that's really what it comes down to. You think about, you know, whether you're an employee, think about a particular employee, let's say somebody who's in the accounting group. Many people in the accounting group, like payroll clerks, for example, are almost certainly non-exempt employees. But when you go to somebody, you go to the next level, well, this person really is performing, making discretionary judgments with respect to matters that are very important to the company's business. Then you may get closer to the administrative exemption. So it really is a case-by-case determination.
Okay, so we have executives. That actually seems, in some respects, sort of easier to understand.
It is easier, yes.
Administrative is a little bit harder,
yeah,
because it's more nuanced. So you really, within administration, people do different things, and some of them exercise judgment, and some of them don't, and you have to sort of look at it more carefully. So then the professional exemption, that sounds pretty good,
yeah,
for the reasons you mentioned earlier, which is that, you know, philosophically, we all sort of think that we are professionals, and that everybody is being treated equally because we're not you know, by the hour kind of people, we're professionals.
Yeah.
Isn't that the safety net that everybody needs?
Unfortunately, another misnomer. The professional employee exemption, although it sounds very broad, is really very narrow. The primary duty must be the performance of work that requires advanced knowledge. For example, Lizette, you and I as lawyers would fall within the professional exemption because we had to go to law school in order to perform our job. So it needs to be in a field of science or learning, and it needs to be, you know, there are some exceptions where it doesn't require an advanced degree, but in most instances, that's really what we sort of, is the default. Does this person have an advanced degree that is necessary in order for that person to perform services? We all have those situations, and clients will often say to me, oh, well, this person, you know, is a CPA. Well, what is the person doing? Well, they're doing something. They didn't like that line of work, so now they've moved into something entirely different, which, you know, they don't fall within that professional employee exemption. Maybe they fall within the administrative exemption, but just the fact that they have an advanced degree in and of itself is not enough.
So we talk about, you know, a lot of our companies, for instance, will have creative professionals.
Yeah.
You know, folks, because they have, you know, whatever their product is, there's a lot of, you know, creative work, marketing, sort of things like that.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a hard one, and I have found that that you really do need to look at the particular job to find out whether the creative professional exemption would work. You know, categories that we've thought of in the past as clearly being creative type work that required a lot of independence in decision making have not necessarily been found by the courts to fall within the creative exemption. So you do want to look at, for example, there was I remember a case that about a Disney animator who was doing very creative work but was not involved in the storyline or it was basically told, here's what you need to do and here's what you need to draw, and that person was found to be non-exempt. So, you know, you really do need to look very carefully at that before you assume that the creative professional exemption applies.
Okay. So onto the computer exemption, which is an important one because you and I have talked about our typical portfolio company in terms of, you know, we invest in technology companies, technology-enabled businesses.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have, we may have sort of a lot of engineers, we may have people obviously doing IT work and so on.
Yeah.
So when I think about computer professional, I think, well, it'll cover sort of people doing IT work.
Yeah.
Because I can barely reboot. So many of us can't do it. That is specialty, if you will. Can you talk, first, give us a little bit of information on the computer professional exception, but also on how it plays out with sort of IT and that kind of special skill that I certainly don't have.
Yeah, no, many of us don't. And so, you know, and many of us are in awe of those folks that can come down and take a computer that doesn't move and fix it. But what's, you know, maybe surprising to many companies is that those people who are really essential to your business and that can are likely non-exempt employees, those help desk employees that you have, the very technically savvy individuals, unless they're doing actual computer programming, systems analysts, or similar jobs like that, that have the primary duty needs to be determining hardware, software, or system functional specifications. They need to be designing programs. Or some sort of combination of these duties. Otherwise, that person does not fall within this computer employee exemption. Now, one thing I think that's important to note about the computer employee exemption that can be helpful is that you actually do have, this is an exception where you do have an hourly, the ability to pay these employees by the hour, provided that they're paid, you know, over 27, at least under the federal law, over $27.63 per hour. So it's one of the few exceptions that you don't necessarily need to follow the salary basis test in order to fall within this computer employee exemption. But the duty test is quite difficult to satisfy.
Okay, so but you touched on something that sort of I think matters, which is that if you have a huge development team, you know, if you're, you know, because of your business,
yeah,
you have a bunch of developers that are creating code, they're making decisions about how the product is being developed, how it's being designed. You know, can you talk a little bit sort of more about that? Because it sounds like there's the IT, there's the help desk folks, and then there's the, you know, there's the engine behind the software that you create, which creates functionality, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So sounds like that latter group likely would fall within this computer employee exemption. But it really, you really do, again, and I hate to be, you know, repeating myself, but you really do need to look at each job. Rather than just saying everyone who falls within, you know, every job title and maybe give the person an elevated job title and think that that's necessarily going to get you there. It really does depend on, is this person, this person in particular, performing that kind of high-level work that Lizette just described? And if so, then you're likely safe and that person can properly be classified as an exempt employee, provided that that he or she is paid appropriately.
So I'll put you on the spot, sort of off slide. As I think about what you just said, you have the person who is, you know, not necessarily sort of a systems engineer, but you have somebody who is working with the CTO, you know, working with the chief technology officer in terms of developing the product. And that person has judgment. That person may end up working 80 hours a week. That person is available all the time. You know, it's senior. They certainly are in the salary bracket. And that person has a team. Mm-hmm. And he has a team of 5, 6, 10, 20 people who are working for them, for him, really, who are taking direction, who may end up working 80 hours a week because when you're sort of in the middle of releasing your next, you know, version, it's going to take a long time, but they really are just doing what they're told. Go create this kind of functionality, or go, you know, fix these bugs, or, you know, do some, you know, quality testing, etc. I think what I sort of heard is that the supervisor, sort of that person who reports to the CTO, still reports to somebody else, but has a role that involves more judgment, more likely exempt under this computer professional exemption. But those people underneath, again, very specifically depending on their job, but it sounds like because they take direction, et cetera, they're more likely to be non-exempt?
Yeah, so that's a good analysis of the issues, although I would say that we may have a couple of exemptions that can apply here.
Okay.
You may have the executive exemption where you have a couple of, where there's a supervisory role there. It would need to be that those five or six, that team that you described is a subdivision or a defined group within the organization. If so, then there's regular supervision. And that individual described has the ability to hire or fire that team, then we may get all the way there with the executive exemption with respect to that individual. The people who are working for him, however, do in fact need to be looked at more carefully. You know, are they really just being, you know, given assignments and being told to do those assignments without really having a lot of independent judgment and discretion with respect to matters of significance? If so, then they would not fall within the administrative exemption. Then we move to the computer exemption, is the level of work that they're doing sufficiently sophisticated to meet the duties test under the employee exemption? So you don't need to look at each of the exemptions. There can be a combination, and an employee can fall under more than one exemption. But you do really need to take each individual employee and then look at all of the exemptions and say, okay, it's not just a field test. It's not, oh, I think this person feels like he's an exempt employee. It's, this person is an exempt employee for this reason. These are the exemptions, which I'm quite confident that employee falls into. And that HR person really should be doing that for every new hire. That's really the most prudent approach.
So before we jump into outside sales exemption, one of the things that I mentioned at the beginning of the webinar, but I want to mention again, once this is over, we will send an email sort of with the slides, or at least with a place to find the slides, and with some resources, because I think that these are kind of thorny issues. You have to look at them very carefully. An experienced HR professional can do it. But even if you have a lot of experience,
yeah,
it's going to be tricky. So, and you don't want to pick up the phone and sort of be on the phone with your lawyer every other day. So
yes,
you want to sort of educate yourself and
yeah,
get smart and at least know what questions to ask. So you have mentioned to me some websites and so on. So we'll make sure that we'll give you guys, following the presentation, some resources.
Right.
You know, they're not going to have the answers,
right,
but they're going to at least give you
some
helpful guidance on what questions to ask and how to get to the right place.
Yeah, and Lizette, I'll, following up on that, I would say that one of the best places to go is to go to www.dol.gov, where they have fact sheets with respect to each of these exemptions, and get those fact sheets and make sure that's part of what you do as when you're hiring and say, okay, now I understand that. And there will be gray areas. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast here. But many times you'll be able to look through the fact sheets and check off the boxes and say, no, I really feel like this person is properly classified as exempt for this reason. Or, you know what? This person really is not going to fit in any of these exemptions. So what are my choices? My choices are really to make absolutely sure that the person works fewer than 40 hours in a week or structure the compensation so that I can anticipate there's going to be some overtime.
Okay. So that's so www.dol.gov. We'll remind people of that afterwards. That's great. Okay. So we've done a few, but there's outside sales exemption.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of our companies have big sales forces and so on. But with technology, it's not like it used to be, right, where everybody
right,
was with their, you know, briefcase out knocking on doors.
Yeah.
You know, now a lot of it is done by email and, you know, PowerPoint presentations done remotely and sort of, you know, web meetings and so on. So does a sales employee really need, I mean, talk about the exemption sort of generally, but does a sales employee really need to travel off-site to fit within the exception? It seems kind of idiotic in this world, 2010.
You know, Lizette, this is really an exemption where the technology is ahead of the law in this area. I get calls on this all the time, and particularly, you know, Some workplaces really do have a clear division between their outside sales force and their inside sales force, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But other workplaces have sort of these folks who are sort of outside salespeople, but they spend a lot of time, most of their time, in the office for the reasons that you just talked about. That's how they communicate with their customers. They're paid well, usually, you know, on a commission basis, and the more they work, the more they get paid. So these people tend to work a lot. And don't receive a salary if they're pure sales folks. Now, do they fit within the outside sales exemption? Well, the good news on this exemption is you don't need to be so concerned about the salary basis test, okay? That if they truly fit within the outside sales exemption, they don't need to be paid a regular salary. They can be a commissioned employee. So that's good news. The not-so-good news is it's pretty hard to fall within this exemption. You do need to customarily and regularly work away from the employer's place of business, and your primary duty must be making the sales or obtaining the orders or contract. So all those folks who work behind the scenes to help the sales happen, those employees, even if they get a piece of the pie, a piece of the sale, are likely not going to fit within this outside sales exemption, and so you need to consider that. It's something that's very it's a hard pill for many of our clients to swallow, which is that inside sales folks really are non-exempt employees.
So, you know, okay, so when before we started the webinar, you and I were talking about, you know, historically, why are these statutes not, you know, in keeping with how we conduct business now?
Yeah.
And you were explaining, and I think it just for 2 minutes, it'd be worth it for the benefit of the group. You were mentioning that we're talking about statutes that were put in place.
1938 was when the FLSA really was enacted. And, yes, there have been updates to the regulation, and many of us were optimistic in 2004 that there'd be a recognition that the outside sales employee, the outside sales exemption, really should include those folks who are working in the office. And as long as they're conducting sales work in the office, that should be enough. But unfortunately, the law came out, it is crystal clear that that's not the case, that inside sales folks are, in fact, non-exempt employees, unless that person can fit within another exemption like the administrative exemption. That's pretty tough. In most instances, inside sales folks and the support personnel are, in fact, non-exempt employees.
So what if I, and to go back to salary, because I think that that's an area where I want to be clear. What if I pay everybody lots of money? What if I pay, I may be a small shop, I don't have, everybody in a way is essential because it's a small business. So everybody's performing some sort of, maybe some people with judgment, maybe some people not, maybe control not, but generally everybody's fairly well paid, and putting in a lot of hours, et cetera. Can I avoid all of these sort of, duties, tests, et cetera, by just sort of basically looking at my employees saying everybody's paid a lot, so
right.
I'm good.
So that's good, right, exactly. And I get that question a lot, too. What do you mean? This person makes $70,000 a year. She just came out of college. She should be dancing in the streets. Never mind suing me for overtime compensation. That's just ridiculous. In fact, the higher you pay employees, if you're under $100,000, the more trouble you can actually get into because when we determine overtime, then overtime is based on the regular rate of pay, and that goes up the higher the salary that you pay the person if that individual has been misclassified. So paying a lot doesn't get you there unless you pay above $100,000, and we'll talk about the highly compensated. Before we do that, you can give another question.
What I was going to say, so what you just said is basically I get somebody, sort of that woman who you described, out of college. In this economy, she should be psyched. She's making $70,000 a year.
Yeah.
And it turns out that she's not performing and she's terminated.
Yeah.
And, she was dancing in the streets before, you just didn't see her, but now she realizes that, she can take her $70,000 and parlay it into a lot more.
Yeah.
As she is unemployed.
That's right.
So she would take the $70,000 and basically break it down by 40.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not by 40, but she would take the equivalent of that sort of on a weekly basis, divided by 40, and that's how you effectively get her hourly rate.
It can get a little bit more complicated than that because there can be some argument that, well, she was paid $70,000, but the offer letter indicated that that's what she should be paid for all of the hours worked, and so then you apply what's called the fluctuating work week methodology to try to reduce the number of the hours of overtime. But in the end, you're right. It's that she figures out what her regular rate of pay would be if it's based on 40 hours. And then any time that she worked in excess of 40 hours will be that regular rate times 1.5, right? So that can become quite expensive, especially when you haven't complied with the record-keeping obligations. And the presumption is that what she said she worked, and people tend to think that they work more than they actually work, is what will be the guidance, unless we can show as an employer that it's something other than that. But taking that example, going forward with completing the thoughts on that example, she then goes and speaks to, let's say, Wendy, plaintiff lawyer. And Wendy says to her, when she first goes to see Wendy, she doesn't talk about overtime at all. She thinks, yeah, I worked hard, but that was sort of the deal. It was a startup company, and I knew I was signing on to that. Instead, she says, I don't think it was a fair termination. I think that they should have given me more time to improve. And so Wendy listens patiently to all of those things and realizes that this individual, we'll call her Jane, doesn't really have a claim based on being treated unfairly and not getting a performance improvement plan. But Wendy's thinking in the back of her mind, what kind of work was she actually doing? Sounds pretty administrative. Sounds like she really, really wasn't given much. The level of her duties were really not that sophisticated. She really wasn't exercising independent judgment and discretion. The real nut here, thinks Wendy, says Wendy, is the overtime issue. And in fact, I can get paid, is what Wendy is thinking, if I can establish that she was misclassified and that she worked any hours in excess of 40, then there's an attorney's fees provision that really does motivate me to take this case and to move forward with it.
So actually, when you say that, you remind me, one of the things you and I had talked about as we were thinking about how why this seminar, this webinar was timely, is the fact that the plaintiff's bar, and you led with this, the plaintiff's bar has woken up more than ever, you know, recently.
Yeah.
You know, 1-800, let's sue them kind of thing, you know. So, and you pointed out to a reason why, in a way, it's sort of free money. You know, there's enough of these out there, and the attorney can really make a compelling case to the client, which is, you know, not only am I going to do right by you, but I'm going to do right by you without, in a way, costing you a ton of money, you know, because there's this, you know, ability to get attorney fees. So,
yeah, let's change the facts just a little bit on that, Lizette. Let's say that she was not fired, right, that Jane wasn't terminated yet. She was just given a really stern warning, and she went to see Wendy to talk about this warning. And she said, you know, this is a real problem here. I think I'm going to get fired, and I feel terrible about this, and I don't think it's fair. And, again, Wendy listens patiently but isn't that interested in that part. Instead, she starts to think about the overtime, and she raises that issue. Now, instead of where they first put her on a performance improvement plan and thought, you know, we're going to give her, let's say, 6 months to try to improve, she then goes and she tells the boss, or they tell HR, and HR tells the boss, and they say, get rid of her. We didn't like her anyway. We don't want her in here. Well, now you've just landed yourself in the middle of a retaliation claim, because Wendy loved that. Now Wendy has the ability to not only sue for the overtime, but for retaliation based on the complaints that she made. Now, would it be a defense that we were going to sue Jane anyway eventually? You know, maybe you work that in, but the fact that she's terminated at that time, right on the heels of making a complaint. So what can happen is somebody raises this issue, and this has happened to many employers, particularly in class action, where you have a whole group of employees who may be suing the employer. And so your employees become plaintiffs in a lawsuit against you as an employer. So it can be a very difficult thing to manage through.
Yeah, it sounds like it's compounding sort of a problem you already have. So now we've gone through the basics, and that example is helpful because it's practical. But, you know, let's assume that, you know, everybody who's listening in is interested. Because, you know, because this is obviously a difficult issue and you may or may not be getting it right, et cetera, but no one has complained. So nobody has raised it as an issue as an employee. You've had either uneventful terminations or, you know, so far you don't have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, how important is it to, you know, change what you're doing under the if it ain't broke, you know?
Yeah.
Is it a legitimate option to just sort of leave it alone?
Yeah.
Because it's difficult because it's going to require you to sort of retrofit your organization. And if you have 3 employees, 10 employees, it's a different, you know, situation than if you have 500.
Yeah.
You know. So how should, as a business person on the phone, how should you think about, you know, a situation where you haven't had a problem yet?
Yeah, this is a really important issue, which is what do you do now that you've identified these problems? Do you put your head in the sand and say, let's just hope for the best, or do you try to change it? And my advice is that, you know, if you don't change it now, then it's not going to get better on its own. And, in fact, as you grow and as you bring on more employees, the problem grows along with you. Many of the companies that I help that are early stage companies really do have this problem from the outset, and I try to advise them to nip it in the bud at the beginning, so that when they become teenage companies and then, you know, young adult companies, and they get ready to get sold and they don't have them, they're very clean in this area. But, you know, that doesn't always happen. It is more cost-effective not to even worry about overtime. You just pay a straight salary. It's certainly administratively easier. So companies sort of just go along with the way that they've done things. By doing that, you're, again, exposing yourself to more and more claims as your workforce grows. You're giving employees unnecessary leverage upon termination. my clients that have major misclassification issues, every time, and there are some that have gone through this and are still reluctant to make the change. Many of clients have made the change, but some are still reluctant. Every time they have to let somebody go, they become very concerned that that person is going to make a claim, if it's someone who they think has been misclassified or potentially has been misclassified, is going to make a claim and open the floodgates. And that once that person makes a complaint, then there are six other people who are, say, inside sales folks who could be also realizing that they have the potential to make a claim too. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, if you do think a sale is on the horizon, then cleaning these issues up sooner rather than later, the process can be somewhat painful, but doing it just makes sense. Now, I will also say, though, that the companies that I have helped that have been very concerned about making these changes have done so successfully, and there are a couple of ways in which you can do it. Some employees that, and this one way that I found effective is if an employer pays a bonus at the end of the year, that's a discretionary bonus. And so the budget is done based on saying, let's say, you know, Jane is going to make in total $80,000 a year, and we expect we'll pay her $70,000 as a salary, and we expect that, you know, she'll make a $10,000 bonus at the end of the year. Instead, you say, okay, well, you present it to the employee that we're going to look at this, and well, we don't, you know, we're not admitting that we've done anything wrong in the past, because it may be a gray area. We'd like to in the future. Continue to pay your salary on a regular basis. You can pay. Doesn't mean just because someone's not exempt, you can still pay them a salary. You don't have to pay them on an hourly basis. That's sort of a misconception many businesses have. You pay the salary, but then you say, and you control the hours. This is particularly effective for people who usually don't work more than 40 hours a week except on an occasional basis. Maybe there's a few weeks during the year when they work more. You say, you know, with respect to those hours, we're going to ask you to keep track of your time, and it can be pretty informal the way that they do it. They you know, keep a sheet at their desk and then turn it at the end of the week. If you do work more than 40 hours in a week, please get approval first, and we'll pay you time and a half. Now, that may affect your bonus at the end of the year, but think about it this way. It's really a pay-as-you-go. That bonus at the end of the year really is discretionary. We may or may not pay it. If you leave early in the year, you don't get it at all. This way, if you work hard, you know, and need to work extra hours during the course of the year, you'll get paid for that. You're assured of that. And people generally like that approach. So that's one way in which you can make the switch that's not too painful, and I've helped clients do that on a number of occasions.
So I'm going to just maybe restate a little bit of what you said to answer a question. So somebody in the audience asked about developers. So developers is a good example of a group that when they're making a push to release or whatever, will work a lot. So take, you know, Joe developer. Mm-hmm. He is getting paid a salary, and we want to keep him a salary. And I thought that was a good point you made, because I think this exempt and non-exempt issue doesn't mean that you have to pay Joe by the hour.
That's right. It just
means you have to pay him overtime.
That's correct.
So you can still keep him on a salary, and he can feel sort of good about being a salaried employee. But Joe would have been paid X base salary and Y bonus under the current regime.
Yeah.
But from time to time, Joe is the kind of guy who, even though he is under supervision, he doesn't have his own judgment, you control him from, you know, all of those things, goes from weeks where he may work 30 hours because it's sunny and beautiful outside and he wants to sort of enjoy the weather, to working 80 hours because there's a big push and everybody's there for, you know, for days at a time. So basically, you would say to Joe, you know, it's six one way, half a dozen the other, you know, on how we're going to do this ultimately. But we're going to take your sort of what would have been your bonus in the past is going to be something that will just, in a way, trickle out to you by you reporting your overtime. So on that week that he works his 30 hours, he's still going to make what he makes every week.
Right.
But on that work that in that week that he makes, he works 60 hours, he's going to make his 40 salary, he's going to report to you his extra hours, and then you're going to somehow sort of compensate him for that.
Yeah.
So it basically, it'll reduce his bonus.
Yeah, so 2 points on that. One is that what you explained to Joe is that your year-end compensation will still be roughly the same, if not higher. Okay, so that's really what that's really what employees care about in the end.
Correct.
Secondly, the example that you just gave, Lizette, and I've mentioned this a couple of times but have been reluctant to get into the details, and I still won't get too detailed about it, but is one where we could apply, if properly structured, a company could use a fluctuating work week methodology and reduce the overtime cost. In a nutshell, what that means is that you pay the person the salary regardless of whether or not they work 30 or 60 hours in a week. But since that's considered to be paying for all of those hours worked, then the hours between 40 and 60, you only need to pay half time instead of time and a half. It's a very effective and not often used way of paying overtime for those employees that have truly fluctuating work weeks, and it's perfectly permissible under the FLSA.
Okay, so
people want to look at state laws on
that. Sure, and depending on so basically, there are creative ways to deal with people who clearly are non-exempt, but who you can, you know, who either have fluctuating work weeks or you want to sort of, you know, who are eligible for bonuses now, et cetera, without making the employee feel that they went from salary and bonus to now getting gypped because of overtime.
Exactly.
So that's helpful. Now, can you talk a little bit about proactive steps, you know, to avoid litigation? And I, you know, we are, just for the benefit of the group, we're trying to stay on schedule. We do have some time to answer some questions. I think our time is good so far. We're getting sort of towards the end of the slides. But there's two things that we've talked about generally. Litigation, so it'd be helpful to talk about, you know, what can people do proactively to avoid litigation? And then maybe we can go back and talk a little bit about deals and how this comes up in the context of deals and, you know, and why we care. So maybe you can talk about sort of proactively trying to avoid litigation and reducing the risk that these misclassification issues affect you sort of in a deal. So maybe start with litigation.
Yeah, I think that the best thing to do as a first step is to conduct an audit of your workforce to find out if this is even a problem, and if so, you know, how big is the problem, and how and does it make sense to try to correct it at this particular time? The manner of which you're going to communicate that. So one of the things that is most important here, and this is really not to try to get lawyers involved in everything, but that you do want to be, to the extent you can, keep that assessment as a privileged document, and then you want to do that. If you're out doing a sort of just go off on your own and conduct a wage and hour audit, you've got to be a little bit careful, because that can be discoverable in litigation down the road. So that's not to say you shouldn't do it, because you should, but it's the way in which you do it. I would advise you to speak with counsel about that. Once you've identified the risks, the next thing to do is, you know, backing up, once you've determined the process for assessing the workforce, you then want to identify the risks by looking at your independent contractor workforce, finding out whether there are state laws that apply, and if there are, then do you meet the test in those various states where the employees reside? And are there, and if not, let's look at the federal test, and do we have concerns under the federal test? And whether there should be, the company should be looking at making those people employees. The next thing to do is to look at your workforce of your, you know, the census of employees. And many of the employees you'll be able to just knock off at the top as clearly fitting into the executive exemption or the administrative exemption and outside sales force. Those folks are clearly not, are going to be exempt. Then you're going to have all these employees sort of in the gray area, and you'll need to really drill down and say, is this employee an administrative employee or fit within the administrative exemption? Is the work that this person does sufficiently sophisticated to fit within the computer exemption? Are they using, you know, is it a CPA who's using CPAs, who needs to have a CPA in order to perform the services that he or she performs for the company? In which case, perhaps that person fits within the professional exemption. But it really is sort of a time-consuming, step-by-step, employee-by-employee assessment. And don't be fooled by job titles, because job titles are not determinative. And be careful of your job descriptions, too. Sometimes you'll have descriptions that will basically say, this person, you know, doesn't really have the will perform these manual tasks, but ultimately needs to make sure that he reports to so-and-so and does, and all things should be bad, and really cuts against an exempt status. Other times those job descriptions can be very helpful, but you certainly want to be aware of them and make sure that they're drafted appropriately to reflect the actual duties of the person. Some instances you may say that the person's really on the cusp, and what we want to do is enhance that person's job duties to make certain that they really are exempt. That's one way in which some of my clients have decided to try to reduce the risk. At other times, there's just a wholesale reclassification of certain employees.
So just and presumably when you do that sort of audit, you're also going to be looking not just exempt or non-exempt, but you're going to be looking at your independent contractors.
Yeah, absolutely. That's even the first threshold question.
That's right, at the outset. So that's helpful. And one of the things to mention as we talk about this, and I want to address one question that we've received that's sort of more specific, but, you know, one of the reasons why this kind of discussion we thought would be helpful is not because the sky is falling, is not because, you know, people are, you know, everybody's doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. It's because more people are doing it wrong than those, you know, who think they are. So it is important to get educated and to appreciate that the questions are nuanced. And I think an audit may tell you that you're doing it right most of the time, but maybe there's a particular group, whether it's your sales force or your IT group or whatever, where that needs to be fixed. So one of the questions that came up was about non-exempt employees who travel and how you deal with travel time.
The rules on travel time are really quite specific, and you do need to be, like, for example, travel to and from work is something that's not compensable time if it's commuting time. But if there's other travel, and it depends on whether you're on an airplane or whether you're on a driving, and there's all sorts of very detailed rules that you need to be paying attention to. But if you have a non-exempt employee that is traveling on a regular basis, it's highly important that you understand those travel rules and that you apply them to that particular employee, because a lot of the time that they are on the road will be compensable time if it's not commuting time. And depending on whether or not, again, they're in the driver's seat or the passenger seat, there's all sorts of very specific regulations relating to that.
Okay, so actually where they're sitting in the car does matter.
It can make a difference,
And I assume that then, since they're not flying the plane,
that can make a difference, too.
Does it make a difference whether they're reading a novel on the plane or working, or just the fact that they're getting on the plane to transport?
If they're working, it's clearly compensable.
Correct.
Right, if it's a non-exempt employee, yeah.
So that's helpful. So let's talk just about deals for a minute. And folks should know that, again, if you want to submit a question, just click on the questions pane in your control panel, type in your questions, and hit send. We'll take a look at here and sort of we'll fold it into the conversation. But on sales of businesses, so the company's thinking about selling itself, or it gets an offer, or it's thinking about going public, and there's going to be some diligence, right? Either the underwriters are going to come in or the buyer's going to come in, and they're going to descend upon you, and they're going to ask you a bunch of questions about how you pay employees, sort of how your business model works, et cetera, and you're going to have to answer them. So ideally, you figure it out, your answers, before those questions get asked. Otherwise, you'll be caught by surprise.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think the challenges will come, I guess, in a few places. First, you're going to have to make representations about being in compliance
with the law. Yep.
So you will have to say, I'm in compliance, I'm not in compliance, you're going to have to make an exception, et cetera. And based on that, they're going to decide whether they think you have a problem or not a problem.
Right.
And they may have different policies than what you have. So it's not just about how you're doing it and doing it right, but you may have to defend them because their view may be, no, you know, you're doing it wrong just because you're not doing it our way, even though you may have appropriate exemptions for the individuals that you have. It's just different than how your buyer is doing it.
Right, and what can happen then is then let's say it's a merger, right? And so then you're folding these employees into the next organization, and the other, the next organization takes the same job duties, and those folks are non-exempt. So they say, yeah, well, you know, when they become employees of the larger organization, they're going to be non-exempt employees. They say, okay, well, all that nuanced work we were going to do about communicating employees and sort of easing them into the transition, that doesn't happen. They said they have the clothing, they become non-exempt employees. They say, well, what about the last couple of years when I worked 60 hours a week? Wasn't I a non-exempt employee then? I was still doing the same thing. And then those are the concerns that the buyer will have. And so when I'm on the side of the buyer, then those are the things that we bring up. Let's say it's an asset deal and you're selling a portion of your business. And then the employees go over again. Some of the employees go with the assets. They become non-exempt employees at the buyer. Then the remaining business it continues to be exposed to those claims that could come from that transition. And they say, well, what if you, target employer in this case, didn't pay me correctly at that time, so I'm going to come back now and sue for all that lost overtime. So that's where it can really come up, and that's why buyers can become very concerned about it.
So just to sort of sneak a question in, we have a question about elaborating a little bit on the highly compensated employee test. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I did go over that pretty quickly. So let's jump back to that, and if we can, I'm not sure if we can get our slide back there. But Lizette asked a very good question about what about if you pay people a lot of money and you get the feeling that, well, they pay too much, they can't be entitled to overtime. And we use the example of the $70,000 employee, which never really got us to where I should have gotten to, which is the highly compensated exemption. The highly compensated test is for employees who make $100,000 a year or more. Okay, those employees, there still is a duties test with respect to those employees, but it's a lax duty test. All of these sort of very, making sure that you satisfy each of the standards is not as important when the person is paid over $100,000 a year. They do need to customarily and regularly perform at least one exempt duty, but that's a pretty easy thing to be able to establish, particularly if you find the person is worth $100,000 a year or more. If the person is not actually paid, and what do I mean by $100,000? Is it straight? Is it benefits and all total comp and all that? No, it is actually cash compensation, but that cash compensation can include non-discretionary bonuses and commissions. There's also the ability to true up employees at the end of the year if they don't meet the threshold. A lot of rules around that too, but I do want to make people aware of the fact that when you do have employees who are making $100,000 a year or more, or very close to it, then there's some work you can do there to get yourself comfortable with the exemption.
Okay, so that's helpful. One thing, and we jumped into this question. We were talking about deals. Like you, I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and it does seem like these issues around employment in the context of deals are coming up more than they were coming up even 4 years ago.
Yeah, certainly.
So there's this sensitivity by buyers, sometimes high-profile buyers. I was talking about this webinar with somebody. They mentioned Microsoft, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, high-profile buyers would be embarrassed, even if they're buying sort of a small company that's sort of going to be folded in, and that's going to sort of reflect upon them because it's going to come back to haunt them. Never mind class actions, but just, you know, something that makes the press. I mean, we've seen the AT&T lawsuit. It makes the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
That's right. And some of them, and if you think about the post-merger, those claims would come against that high-profile company, and that could make the failure to pay overtime could be perceived as being a chink in the armor, that they feel like they've been very careful about wage and hour issues, and I've had this come up a number of times. With particular companies that take great pride in the fact that they properly classify and pay their employees, and they haven't been subject to these class actions. And then when they do an acquisition, they worry about being exposed. And so that's something that sometimes the reputational issue cannot even be fully, the buyer may not be fully satisfied through just indemnification, because it's not just about money. They don't want to be perceived as a company that is open to these overtime claims, like Walmart, for example, that just got slammed over the last few years.
Yeah, so that's helpful. So I think that we've sort of managed to weave the questions that we've received throughout the discussion. So before we close, and if anybody else has any other questions, you know, feel free to get them to us. Before we close, Jennifer, I don't know if there's sort of anything that you want to say more generally about technology companies that are sort of looking at this issue, thinking about the person making the decisions on classification, whether they should go back and try to retrofit their situation, you know, and if you're talking about a very large company, that could be very disruptive, certainly for an HR person who already has his or her hands full.
Yeah, I guess just in a nutshell, and this is somewhat repetitive what we've already said, but that, you know, understanding the issue is very important, and putting your head in the sand on it may be the more comfortable approach right now, but eventually my experience is it does crop up. I have a number of clients that were sort of early stage clients that became teenage clients that were then getting ready to be sold, and they then called and said, oh, remember you told us a few years ago about that exempt versus non-exempt, and that was too much trouble at the time. We had 5 employees to make the change, and now we have, you know, 500 employees, and now we really don't want to make the change, but we're trying to get ready and be in compliance before we get ourselves polished up for sale. What are we going to, you know, how do we do that? And I help them through that process, but it really would be a lot easier if they sort of, you know, realize the issue sooner rather than later. And so that would be my general advice, is try to get a handle on how big the issue is. And then there are solutions out there that can make this less painful, and ways to communicate it that will make it less painful and will not necessarily expose you to, you know, litigation for all the back overtime that maybe should have been paid in the past. So that's sort of my general advice, is get a handle on it. Feel free, you know, make sure that somebody, here's something else, somebody on a going forward basis should really be charged with the responsibility of assessing these issues at the higher stage. Someone should get a really good working knowledge of the exemptions, what they are, and not just apply the field test whenever somebody is hired when determining whether or not the person should be an independent contractor or an employee, or if an employee exempt or non-exempt.
Great. So we're going to wrap up a little earlier. I'm sure that everybody has something to do in the extra 10 minutes they'll get. On behalf of Jennifer and myself and Goodwin Proctor and Battery Ventures, we hope that you have found this helpful, that you've gotten sort of what we promised, some basics, some practical advice, and following the call, you know, some resources that you can use beyond here. And if you have any questions, Jennifer, we'll make sure that contact information is available and that we can help you as you go along. So thanks again for your time.
Thank you.